Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 5th of January. Monday at 9, we have All Things Political. And our guest this hour is Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University, where he teaches courses on American politics, international relations, European politics, American foreign policy, comparative policy, and also presents an on-site workshop each year at the United Nations. So he's a perfect guy for the analysis today because we'll be looking at the Middle East and we'll look at the incoming administration and the resumption of the Congress tomorrow and who will be seated and who may be challenged. And we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we can also take emails, I believe. And yes, we can. Rob tells me, yes, we can. To do that, it's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org for you to join us that way. And we would like to greet Professor David Michael Green. David Michael Green, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Good morning, Kathleen, and Happy New Year to you and all my good friends in Wisconsin.
Happy New Year to you as well.
Thank you.
Well, the new president has something else to deal with now. I'm wondering about the timing of the Israeli troops going into Gaza and the continuation of fighting there, despite efforts by some diplomats to say, can you have a ceasefire here? Why is this happening now?
Well, the answer that Israel would give is because Hamas, who is the political party that controls the Gaza Strip, has broken a ceasefire that was brokered about 6 months ago and has been continuing to launch a series of rockets into neighboring towns in southern Israel. And so the answer the Israeli government would give is that they've, you know, become fed up with that and they're tired of the security risk. And so they haven't made entirely clear what their full objectives are, but certainly one of them is to eliminate the risk of rocket damage from coming from Gaza. So what they want to do is they want to at least take out those rocket installations and the capacity of Hamas to attack. Now, whether they want to go further than that and try to damage Hamas, you know, in a significant way, or even try to reoccupy Gaza, they're not saying. They have said that they don't want to reoccupy Gaza, but it's unclear where they're going. And the reason I raise that is because I think that, you know, that would give us some clue as to the why and the timing of this attack. So we don't really know the answer to that question other than what the Israeli government is saying.
It would appear that they are trying to damage Hamas in a very significant way.
Yeah, absolutely. And there may be, you know, I mean, many people have speculated as to what they're really up to. And it may very well be exactly what they present, that, you know, there's a security risk to not only to Israel, but particularly to civilians in southern Israel. That it could be purely that, or that could be part of the equation. As you know, and your listeners will know, a similar scenario unfolded to Israel's north in southern Lebanon about 2 years ago. And that really didn't end very well for Israel. And in particular, what it did is it shattered what one might describe as kind of a myth of Israeli invincibility, which was not mythical at the time, unless you, you know, take the word to mean sort of a widely shared belief. But I mean, it was fairly true. But following that incursion, which didn't end well for Israel, in 2006, Israel has been seen as, you know, there's a chink in the armor now. And so some people have speculated that, one of the reasons for the attack into Gaza is to try to restore the credibility of the Israeli military threat.
Mm-hmm. Do you, not that these do anything, but I would imagine there might be some kind of special envoy. If so, what would his or her mission be when we have a new administration?
Well, to try to broker, you know, sort of the old Henry Kissinger formula of shuttle diplomacy, perhaps, or it might be a multilateral effort. The Europeans especially, I think, are very interested in, you know, among various Western partners, are very interested in seeing this conflict end. I think most of the world is, in particular, and the Bush administration has been very hands-off about this, you know, what one might describe in some ways as the last remaining major conflict between Israel and its neighbors. And the Bush administration, of course, has been very much focused on Iraq and Iran, perhaps less so, but significantly on Syria, and then there's Afghanistan. And so where previous administrations had, you know, going back at least to Nixon and Kissinger's shuttle diplomacy, had you know, been very hands-on and tried to broker peace agreements. One thinks, you know, famously of the Camp David Accords under Carter, and then Clinton doing the same thing in the last days of his administration. The Bush team for the last 8 years has been really rather hands-off and rather unilaterally supportive of Israel. I mean, I think the United States' posture in the post-war period has always been, you know, Israel's security first, but as the decades unraveled, as we got into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there was a greater sense in the Middle East and elsewhere that the United States was, as well as wearing that hat, was also seen as kind of the honest broker that could be mm-hmm. trusted by both sides. And the Bush administration has walked away from that and walked away from trying to negotiate any sort of peace agreement. So I would expect the Obama administration to delegate somebody to try to deal with that, although I don't think it's going to be a top priority for them unless you have continuing violence like we have today. If the war is over, you know, a week from now, I do think that they will tend to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in ways that the Bush people haven't, but I don't think it's going to be one of their top priorities, even in the foreign policy domain, which I think is going to be secondary to their priorities on the domestic front anyhow.
Right. Do you think this war will be over a week from now?
I really can't say. It's very hard to know because, you know, primarily because I don't think we really know what Israel's objectives are. And frankly, none of them look terribly good from the Israeli perspective. I'm not sure that the Israelis have gotten themselves into something that can possibly end terribly well for them. Again, they don't want to reoccupy Gaza. I think that's you know, that's a nightmare that they don't want to take on again. They only just left Gaza about 3 years ago. And as listeners may know, it's reputed to be the most densely populated place on the planet, and certainly one of the poorest. So I don't think they want to be in the business of governing that. They probably would like to deal a lethal blow to Hamas, but quite potentially they're doing the opposite here. That is to say, they may be rallying support for Hamas out of outrage, both in Palestine and elsewhere, as to what they're doing. Which I should say, by the way, is you know, seen in much of the world, and certainly in the Palestinian world, as whatever the provocation may have been, is highly disproportionate to that. And also I think one of the interesting angles to this from the perspective of Israeli foreign policy is that the longer this goes on, the more likely they are to drive away allies, both in the region and elsewhere. I mean, I don't think Hamas is widely loved, say, in Egypt or Jordan or Turkey. And also, frankly, in the West Bank. But the longer Israel presses this offensive and the more bloody it is, the harder it is for those states and quasi-states who are, frankly, sort of tipping towards Israel in recent years to continue to do that. And so it becomes, I think, counterproductive as it goes on. It may already be quite counterproductive for Israel, but it all depends on what their objectives are. And I really don't know them. I'm mm-hmm. not sure anybody outside the Israeli government knows them.
Mm-hmm. Governor Bill Richardson withdrawn as the nominee for Secretary of Commerce. This must be a serious investigation, huh? What's going on there?
I don't know a lot about it, but what I understand is that there's an allegation of a kind of pay-to-play relationship with a financial firm that had previously won state contracts in New Mexico after donating money to his campaign. There were, I think, several incidents, but one is this. In 2003, the company, which is known as CDR Financial Products, gave $25,000 to a Richardson PAC. And then Richardson launched a program once he became governor called GRIP, which is Governor Richardson's Investment Partnership, which is a highway construction program. And CDR Financial Products, lo and behold, won about $1 million worth of financing work on that particular project. Now, Richardson said he's done nothing wrong, but he claims that he's withdrawing his nomination because the investigation would have delayed the confirmation process. But the AP has reported back in mid-December that there's a grand jury investigation now going on into how CDR won its contract. So I don't know what the scope of this will be, but potentially it could be large, yes.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that he was urged to withdraw, that it wasn't, or he probably never would have put his name up as a possibility, right?
Right. Well, interestingly, Richardson, I think, initially wanted to have the Secretary of State slot, which, of course, who doesn't, right? Everybody.
Right.
I mean, that's the plum job in the cabinet. And interviewed with Obama for that. And Obama, you know, conceivably could be seen to owe Richardson favors. I mean, Richardson famously came out for Obama during the election cycle and angered many Clinton fans, not least of which James Carville, who called him a Judas for doing that. But he was given instead the commerce slot. And I think probably the Obama camp, when it began to see the magnitude of this, probably asked him to withdraw. And, I mean, one of the things that's very interesting about this is that the transition and the assembling of the Obama team has been virtually flawless.
Right.
And I don't remember another case where they've been, you know, quite so up on their execution in terms of other presidencies being launched. And so this is the one kind of exception to that now, the one flaw. But it's a minor one, I think, particularly because of the timing of it. I mean, it would have been different had he, in fact, become the Commerce Secretary and then this blew up.
Mm-hmm. Has Al Franken won?
I think so, but I guess you'd have to ask Norm Coleman's legal staff about that. Their answer would probably be different. But Franken originally lost the election by the initial count. I think that the tally was about 200 votes in Coleman's favor, if I remember correctly. And this is going back to early November. But the margin was so small that, according to Minnesota state law, that triggered a mandatory hand recount. And there were over 3 million ballots that were cast in that election. And so since that time, by and large, that recount has been going on. And the expectation is today that the state canvassing board will certify Franken today as the winner by the whopping margin of 225 votes. And that's controversial for a number of reasons, particularly in the Coleman camp. And the expectation is that Coleman will file a lawsuit for one or perhaps several reasons challenging that outcome. He has 7 days from the date upon which the canvassing board makes its announcement to file a lawsuit if he chooses to do that. So it looks to me like the canvassing board is going to declare Franken the winner, that Coleman will challenge, and then I don't know how long that legal battle will transpire. The Senate is beginning work tomorrow. There was some talk. Chuck Schumer from my state, New York, was saying, you know, maybe Franken ought to be seated originally with the Senate tomorrow. And John Cornyn, who's a senator from Texas, said, well, if you do that, we're going to filibuster. So the new Senate term would get off to a fantastic start
with
a filibuster on day one. So I don't think that's going to happen. But
yeah.
In the end, my suspicion is probably that Franken will wind up with the seat.
Huh. And what about Roland Burris? Will he be sworn in tomorrow? First, there was, we can't seat this guy. This is, you know, too shady, the circumstances. And now the Democrats seem to be backtracking. Well, maybe we should seat him.
To my knowledge, he won't be sworn in. To my knowledge, unless there's been recent developments that I'm unaware of, the leadership, the Democratic leadership in the Senate do not want to seat Roland Burris because not because of anything related to him, but obviously because he's tainted by the governor, Rod Blagojevich, who chose him. And they had been asking, everybody basically has been asking Blagojevich, first of all, to resign, but more emphatically even, not to make this pick for exactly this reason. Because even though there's no allegation against Roland Burris personally, and there's no allegation that I've heard of that there was any quid pro quo involved in the selection, the very fact that Blagojevich, who, you know, obviously your listeners will know this story, you know, because he is so tainted, and this selection process is now so tainted because of the conversations that he had that were caught on tape and now have been released to the public, that he simply should not be seated. And so last I heard, Harry Reid and the Senate leadership were fairly emphatic that they did not want to seat Burris.
We welcome phone calls. It's All Things Political, always Monday at 9 o'clock, and our guest is Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University. Our phone number, lines are open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or you can send an email, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, it's our January open line, so call with your ideas for programs from 9 to 11. All right, two phone calls now for Professor David Michael Green at 800-486-8655, and we start with Mike from New Berlin. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning, Professor. Two quick questions, and I'll take the answer off the air to give other callers a chance. With the new administration coming in, to what extent do you think President-elect Obama's decision to pick Hillary Clinton and his decision at this point not to select the CIA director or a national intelligence director, to what extent do you think that gives us some clue as to what he's thinking about the Middle East, in particular the Palestinian problem? I know Hillary Clinton in the past has endorsed a two-state solution, and I think Ahmadinejad is up for re-election here in the next maybe a year or two at the outside, and there's speculation that maybe he won't be re-elected. Do you think his decision not to select a CIA director at this point is maybe he's playing wait and see to try and get a CIA director that will, you know, have some influence in that process? And then secondly, just as I heard you talking before about the Illinois situation, why won't they have a special election? Is Harry Reid and the Democrats just, you know, torturing in a twisted fashion, trying not to have an election because they're afraid that maybe a Republican would win that one?
As to the first question, I guess my tendency would not be to try to read too much into the appointments that Obama's made. I mean, I really do think that this is going to be kind of the classic model of governance where Obama is going to be the policymaker. You know, the sign on his desk will say the buck stops here, and I think that will be fairly literally the case, so that you've seen kind of a fair array of appointments in his cabinet and on his team, although they tend to lean more rightward than many people had expected, certainly many progressives who backed him. But I'm not sure yet that that has any particular meaning in terms of policy decisions. It certainly may have some meaning in terms of how lesser decisions are made and what information gets to the president. But I think on the big questions that Obama's going to be making the decisions, and my suspicion is, I guess, a couple things about the Middle East that I sort of had already articulated. One is that I don't think that this is going to be, unless events require it to be, I don't think this is going to be a high priority for the Obama administration, because I think, first of all, they're going to be focused like a laser beam on domestic issues, and by that I mean basically the economy. Even other domestic issues, I think, are going to be falling to the wayside. And first of all, that's necessary, but secondly, it's really politically smart. If you remember George H.W. Bush at the end of his administration back in 92 or so, was really seen as being focused on foreign policy issues, which he was more interested in, much to his detriment, because the economy was in a recession and people were upset that their president wasn't focused on the economy. And I think that the Obama people understand that lesson. And so I think, first of all, they're going to be focused on the economy. And secondly, I think that what you'll find is that his Middle East policy is very centrist. You mentioned the two-state solution. I mean, I think that's almost everybody's solution at this point, including the Israeli government's. And so I think I don't expect that he, regardless of who he appoints or doesn't appoint, will fall outside of those boundaries very much at all. And then with regard to the Illinois case, I suspect what's going on there is that there's no provision for a special election under these conditions. And so people are waiting to see what happens, whether Blagojevich will solve the problem for them, which he apparently is not going to do. And so, as I understand it, the legislature is now moving to impeach him, and they may decide to try to legislate a special election. But I think the answer to the question may be that there's simply no provision for that at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's talk more about this economic stimulus package. The Wall Street Journal reporting today that Obama and congressional Democrats are putting together a plan to offer $300 billion in tax cuts to individuals and businesses. They say it's a move aimed at attracting Republican support for an economic stimulus package and prodding companies to create jobs. The size of the proposed tax cuts, which would be about 40% of a stimulus package that could reach $775 billion over 2 years, is greater than many anticipated and may make it easier to win over Republicans. What do you think?
Right. Well, you know, let's come back to the politics of this. I mean, I think this is going to be very fascinating, and it's maybe going to be the first test of a much larger question, which is how are Republicans going to deal with this new administration, and particularly in the context, number one, of, you know, a series of major crises. Frankly, America is really, you know, grappling with a whole series of serious issues right now, especially the economic situation, which looks to be worse than any time since the 1930s. So how are they going to deal with the new Obama administration in that context, and also in the context of their own kind of political demise? I mean, the Republicans are really in a tough position right now, and I think they have to be very careful about how they act in the coming months and years. With regard to the stimulus, it seems that Obama has in mind a kind of classic Keynesian package, which involves both tax cuts and government spending, albeit on a kind of massive proportions. You mentioned the number $775 billion. Some people are saying that this could actually even rise to $1 trillion. But even if it's only, I mean, the numbers are, you know, aren't they astonishing?
I mean, yes, they are.
Now we're talking about having $1 trillion. A deficit for the first time in American history, and it almost becomes kind of funny money. You know, I mean, people just—you can't even grapple with them. But what Obama's talking about is a massive spending program that would involve particular attention to infrastructure and green energy projects, and also I think some healthcare projects, and also certain benefits like unemployment insurance and that sort of thing. And then also, as you mentioned, Kathleen, a very large stimulus via tax cuts, which, as he promised during the campaign, would be more oriented towards working people rather than economic elites. So I would think that was part in fulfillment of a campaign promise, part in fulfillment of the notion of how do we stimulate the economy, but also an attempt perhaps to bring Republicans on board for this question.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Walt from Tomahawk next, our caller. Hi, Walt.
Hi, Kathleen, and Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Walt.
I would like to go back to the Israeli-Palestinian question just for a moment. It's way too complicated for me to decide which side is right or wrong. But my question is, when they do finally have a ceasefire and Hamas sends the rockets over into Israel, everybody seems to think Israel shouldn't do anything to retaliate. And I'm just curious, you know, why is that?
Well, I think there are several answers to this. One has to do with the notion of proportionality, which actually is not only a, you know, kind of a moral issue, but is part of international law, you know, the law of warfare, such as it is. I mean, international law is a very weak institution, but it does exist, and there are long-held doctrines about proportional response. That's part of it. And so, you know, the rockets that Hamas has fired at Israel, which no doubt induce a great deal of terror and some small amount of damage, I think perhaps, I don't know that I have the numbers exactly right, but if they've killed anybody, it's in the ones or twos and have wounded a few people. So now what you have with the invasion of Gaza is, last count, something like 500 Palestinians killed in the last 10 days, and that number rising. And so there, and the very invasion itself, of course, is a very large kind of footprint. So there's the question of proportionality. And then the other thing that I think leads Israel's critics to be pretty hard on it whenever these events kind of flare up is the very fact of the occupation. The occupation goes back to one of a series of wars between Israel and its neighbors, this one in 1967. And after Israel won that war, it continued to occupy about four key territories, two of which, the Sinai and Gaza, it's now given back, but one in particular that really irks many people, the West Bank, it continues to hold and continues to make it very difficult for the Palestinians to form a state. And many people, again, this has also roots in international law, that occupation is illegal according to international law, but morally I think it's also very offensive to people, and the treatment of the Palestinians is seen in the international community often to be very offensive. And so those two factors, and then one last factor that I guess I would mention that's also peculiar to the Gaza case, and that's that what the Palestinians claim is that, yes, indeed, Israel did give Gaza back 3 years ago, and so you know, Gaza is autonomous, as the Israelis are fond of claiming, but there's been a blockade and a sort of economic stranglehold on Gaza all this time, ever since then. And so this very impoverished community continues to kind of sink into further poverty because Israel controls its airspace, it controls its ports in the Mediterranean. Egypt has essentially blocked the border there. And so, I guess one might say that that the criticism of Israel is unfair if you look at just a kind of a snapshot. If you look at the wider context, then you begin to see a picture that's more balanced, and there's kind of room for criticism all around, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I appreciate that. That was a very complete answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Walt. You're quite welcome, and Happy New Year to you, Walt.
Bye-bye.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. It's All Things Political. This Monday, as always happens, Monday at 9 o'clock, so join us on anything political, because that's what we're talking about. Let's go back to the Obama administration, now only a couple weeks away from being inaugurated. Does this administration need to make significant legislative progress on an economic stimulus package, on something else, to be off and running in a successful fashion?
Yes, I think so. I mean, the analogy that I keep making to this moment and to Obama and to the political landscape in America right now is to 1932. And, of course, we famously often speak of the 100 days, which was the, you know, rapid legislative agenda that FDR was able to put through a very Democratic Congress at the time to try to deal with what was, you know, a very dire economic situation. Not unlike our situation now, except, of course, it was much worse. You had about 25% unemployment in 1932, a staggering amount. And, of course, you didn't have any kind of social safety net then. That part of what Roosevelt did was to begin to create that. Today we have something of a social safety net. It pales, of course, compared to, you know, what you might find in Europe. But there's something there, so that even if we had 25% unemployment right now, there would be some governmental assistance that really didn't exist back then. But apart from those differences, I mean, I think the situation is very analogous. And as is widely understood, Roosevelt didn't, throughout really the duration of the 1930s, wasn't able, legislatively or otherwise, to essentially to solve the problem of the Great Depression. I mean, most economists, I think, would agree that it was really the stimulus of World War II that ultimately did that. But he was a very popular president because I think he was seen as working hard to try to do that. And, of course, I think most Americans, you know, that's enough for most Americans. I mean, they want to see that you're on the case. And I think this is crucial for Obama. And this is why I keep saying, Kathleen, that I think he's very likely to have a laser-like focus on this, even though there are, you know, major environmental issues, major foreign policy issues, major security issues that are, you know, cannot be ignored and will be bubbling up all the time. I think Obama needs to be and will be very much focused on the economy. And Congress is going to have to move something pretty quickly in terms of a stimulus plan in order for him to be seen as a successful president.
Right.
I think that may be the single key determinative factor in the early months and years of his presidency in terms of how he's perceived by the public.
And will that be difficult? Is there going to be significant Republican opposition to his plan just to show that they mean business too and they're a strong opposition party? Or do you think that the streets are so dire that everybody's going to jump on board here and try to figure out something right away?
Well, that's a really fascinating question. I mean, I think that's, you know, in terms of American politics as opposed to government or policy, I mean, I think that's kind of the most interesting question of our time. What is the Republican Party's strategy going to be? It's really in a very tough situation, the Republican Party is, and I don't see many winning possibilities for them. Legislatively, I mean, the numbers are fairly crushing in the House, and the way the House works, if you're in the minority, even by one seat, and the majority has good party discipline, you might as well be in Siberia. In the Senate, of course, it's different, and this is why all of these Senate seats we've been talking about are so crucial. As it turns out, this election brought the Democrats, you know, within view of the promised land, but didn't get them there.
Right.
So if Al Franken is seated, that will give them effectively 59 seats, either held by Democrats or with folks who caucus with Democrats. And that's one short of the magic number of 60, which you need to break a filibuster. So what that means is that the Republicans have lost control of the entirety of the government, except they, by one vote, they have the possibility in the Senate, even though they're in the minority, of filibustering and blocking legislation. And over the last 2 years, they've actually done, I think, a record amount of that. They've certainly done it a lot. And I think I saw at one point that they had shattered records for the number of filibusters that they had conducted to block Democratic legislation. Now, having been sort of crushed in two elections in a row, having had their policies and their president repudiated in two elections in a row, the real question is, you know, do they want to now, in the context of a public that's really hurting, really demanding solutions, just gave a mandate to the Democrats and a Democratic president, do they want to be seen to using this minority status in the Senate to filibuster mm-hmm. and to block, you know, life raft legislation? And I don't really think they do, but, you know, I mean, the Republican Party is populated by some pretty hardcore ideologues, and they may well do that. My suspicion is if they do that, it will cost them tremendously, and they're already in a very difficult situation.
More phone calls in just one moment for All Things Political. Our guest this hour is Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University, and he teaches courses on American politics, international relations, European politics, American foreign policy, and more. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our show this Monday is our January open line. So put on your thinking caps and come up with ideas of programs you'd like to hear, guests, a book that you've read that you thought was spectacular and you'd like for us to interview the author. That will be at 10 o'clock today. Call with your suggestions. We do this once a month, and believe me, we do listen to you. We've scheduled many of your recommendations. So we will do that, and that will be after the news from National Public Radio at 10 o'clock today. Back to your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we go to Al from Milwaukee next. Hi, Al.
Hi, good morning. I think it's important that your listeners should know Israel doesn't have clean hands in this. The American newspapers really sanitize accounts of things that go over there. Those who want to know have to read the Israeli papers, and as an example, I'll tell you how this current problem came about. I've been looking at Israeli papers over the past year. Three or four times a week, it's announced in the Israeli papers that Israel made midnight or late-night raids, and they arrested 10 people in the West Bank. Occasionally, it's announced that during this arrest raid, somebody was killed. Well, you then find a day or two later, there is a rocket from Gaza into Israel. And that's been going on during the past 6 months. Hamas has pretty well not done anything, but the other groups have sent rockets into Israel after Israel made these raids and killed Palestinians in the West Bank. What ignited what's happening right now was several days before the December 19th end of the truce, which was when it was scheduled to end, Israel fired across the border into Gaza and killed three Hamas men. At that point, Hamas decided that it would not renew the truce, and the rockets attacks intensified, and that's how we got to where we are today. People should not think that this is poor, innocent little Israel getting attacked. They have been provoking it all year long by attacking and killing Palestinians in the West Bank.
Okay, Professor Green.
Well, I would agree with Al that from what I understand that one gets a more critical perspective on Israel from the Israeli press than the American press, oddly enough. But having said that, and I think that he points to, you know, some interesting information in terms of what precipitated the current situation. But this is an endless cycle.
Right.
I mean, behind every attack by one side is an attack by the other side, and then behind that is an attack by the other side. And unraveling that, I think, is sort of a fool's errand, and trying to assign blame based on that. I mean, this is like a, you know, generational-long, if not millennial-long, blood feud, essentially, between warring tribes or families. And so there's always going to be a response to something that was a response to something that was a response to something else. And so I don't see particularly, I mean, if you're looking at this from the perspective of trying to figure out a solution here, I don't see that game as terribly useful. If you are trying to look for a solution, I think, first of all, you have to kind of let the past be the past. And there's plenty of, I think, guilt to be assigned on both sides, as far as I can see. And then you have to move to the question of, you know, what are we going to do about this? The only viable solution, I think, is a two-state solution, and you have to try to figure out how do we get from here to there. But if one continues to hold on to grievances based on past atrocities, there's no possibility of unraveling that or getting to the bottom of that barrel, and I just don't see it as a terribly productive discussion, I guess, if you're trying to figure out how to solve the problem.
Would that the problem could be solved. It just goes on, and people don't forget the past, do they?
No, it is possible that it's soluble. I mean, I'd like to be a little bit more hopeful in that respect, and not in a Pollyannish way either. I mean, if we look at Europe, for example, Europe is in the period which scholars now describe as the long peace. Western Europe hasn't had war since 1945, and that's an incredibly remarkable thing, even though, you know, we're so used to it, we kind of don't even think about it anymore. But in Europe's prior history, there was nothing but warfare, and that problem seems to be solved. And if you look even at the Middle East, Israel now has pretty good relations with countries like Egypt and Jordan, perhaps the new Iraq government, certainly good relations with Turkey. And so that situation is much better than it was several decades ago. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, I think that kind of the last knot to be unraveled in terms of the fallout from 1948 and then 1967, again, is this Palestinian question. And I don't think it's insoluble. I mean, I think that there are possibilities here. The only thing that strikes me that makes it potentially insoluble is if there are radicals on either side who, and there are on both sides, who are unwilling to envision this two-state solution. In particular, say, if Hamas is committed, as it claims itself to be, to a Palestinian region that does not include Israel, or as they would probably phrase it, the Zionist entity. If they are committed to the eradication of a Jewish state and they continue to have power, then there won't be a solution there. And the same on the Israeli side. I mean, if there are radical Israelis who are committed to the Palestinians not having a state, and if they have power, then there won't be a solution. But apart from that, if you can marginalize those elements, or at least diminish the degree of power that they exert over the question, Truly, I mean, these are difficult problems to unravel, but I don't think that it's insoluble, and I think history suggests to us that it can be done.
Mm-hmm. Al, thanks for your call. Anne from Madison, hi.
Hi. Well, first, I think that if somebody locked us in an airtight jar and denied us food and water and medicine and everything we need for life, there would be guerrilla fighters, as there are in Israel, who were lobbying everything possible to get some air in that jar. So I really think Israel is responsible for the immediate crisis. I can't believe that we're not withdrawing our aid from Israel until they open the borders. But I had a couple of questions. One is, I think this is a lie about tax cuts. It's based on the trickle-down theory. It didn't work during the Reagan administration. It's not working now that Hank Paulson has control of hundreds of billions of dollars and is hoarding it for his rich friends. It's not going to work because our tax base is so impoverished. What we need is, again, to force the rich to pay their fair share of tax monies. And their bribes to our legislators are preventing them from doing that. And Obama, if he buys into it, won't be significantly different from Republicans. And third, the idea that Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi are still going to be the leaders of the Democrats in Congress is just mind-boggling to me. They haven't done anything. They followed rather than led. They did whatever the Bush administration told them to do and then shut up about it. And Nancy Pelosi refused even to submit the House Judiciary Committee resolution of contempt against Karl Rove to the full House. She refused to do it. She apparently knew about the illegal wiretapping. She knew about the torture, and she was a good little girl and held her tongue. And I think both these people ought to be replaced right away. They shouldn't be holding these jobs for life.
Professor Green.
Well, let me spin through those in order. With regard to the Gaza stranglehold, I mentioned that earlier. I mean, I think that's a very valid point. And, the Gazans have been extremely angry and frustrated over this, and one might even describe their response to it as fairly tepid, given that provocation, given the difficulties under which they've been placed by the Israeli blockade. With regard to the tax cuts, I completely agree with Anne with respect to tax cuts as we've known them from Reagan through Bush, too. Obama, of course, has promised a different kind of tax cut, one which would go to non-elites. And in fact, as he mentioned during the campaign, the economic elites, maybe the top 5%, would actually have tax increases. And to my mind, if he actually does that, then that could be a legitimate stimulus, because generally speaking, if you're, you know, sort of living hand-to-mouth, and all of a sudden you get $1,000, you're going to spend that $1,000, whereas if you're an economic elite, you probably will not. So if you spend that money, then you're stimulating the economy, and we have the ripple effect cycling out from there. With regard to Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi, I mean, I couldn't frankly agree with the caller more. I think they've been extremely weak leaders of an extremely weak Democratic Party, which to my mind has been really rather complicit in a lot of the damage that's been done by the Bush administration over the last 8 years, in large part because they failed to even exert, you know, minimal congressional oversight during the last 2 years in which they controlled Congress. I will say two things, though. I mean, one is that I think that's what the Democratic Party seems to want right now. Whether, you know, you and I as citizens want that is a different question. And the other thing is that strategically, one might argue that they've been wise to do this. Many people, of course, wanted to see impeachment proceedings, for example, after the Democrats took control of Congress in early 2007. And I think the notion that Reid and Pelosi and other Democratic leaders had was that, look, if we overplay our hand here, if we're seen as hounding the Bush administration, you know, that's not going to benefit us in 2008. And one might argue that strategically that they were right. Now they have control of, you know, both of the political branches of the United States government, and it might not have turned out that way had they really, you know, done extensive oversight. As a citizen, though, and in terms of constitutional responsibility, there's another argument to be made here. And if one believes, as I do, that the Bush administration has been quite damaging in terms of, you know, not only policy issues, but in terms of the institutions of American government and, you know, abiding by the rules of the Constitution, it strikes me that, you know, as a leader in Congress, you should put that above the question of political gains, and that you should fulfill your responsibility to the Constitution and to the public. But Reid and Pelosi and, frankly, the Democratic Party have not taken that tack. It's a very centrist, I would describe it as a very anemic party. And, frankly, the caller is right, Anne is right. Over the last 2 years, they've accomplished almost nothing.
So who would you prefer to see in the leadership positions?
Well, I mean, I admire some, you know, bolder and I guess I would say more progressive figures within or around the Democratic Party. You know, Bernie Sanders might be a good choice. Russ Feingold, I think, would be a great choice. Let's see, who else? Well, that's a good start anyhow. Folks who I think I would describe as very principled and also fairly progressive in their politics. Yeah, having said that, I have to note, you know, a caveat here, which is that some of those people have, whom I thought were in that category, have proven kind of disappointing. Some folks who, when they were in the minority, were making noises about how, you know, what the Bush administration was doing was quite outrageous. When they actually got gavels in their hands, became very muted after that point. So, you know, one never knows what will happen when they actually have the authority to use those powers. But Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi are not my models, at least for, and you know, historically, I mean, these were not, no one will ever say that these are sort of the great kind of Sam Rayburn figures of congressional leadership. And also politically, I think they're extremely centrist, extremely sort of tepid in their politics.
Thank you, Ann, for your call. And we go to Bob from Lowell next. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. My question is, I keep hearing this talk about how bad Israel is because of what they're doing, but yet I don't hear a lot of talk about what's really going on. Ever since the days of the early days of the PLO, they have used different organizations, schools and hospitals, to launch their attacks and their missiles and their terrorist attacks, and then turn around and blame Israel for responding. Hamas launches missiles. The Palestinians are the ones who are allowing them to operate out of there. If they had put a stop to it, Israel wouldn't have to do what they do. But yet it's, and again, they talk about bringing in food aid and humanitarian supplies using United Nations routes. Well, every one of those routes that come in, arms come in with it, the missile supplies come in with it, nobody does nothing. I've spent time in the Middle East. They have no problem using schools and hospitals to launch attacks. But yet when you have to respond to it, then all of a sudden Israel is evil because of what they're doing. When is there going to be, you know, some truth in what's really going on, and the finger-pointing in Israel turn back around and put the blame on the Palestinians? Israel pulled out of the Gaza Strip, turned it over to them, and what happened almost immediately? They started launching missiles. As long as I can remember, and I'm 55 years old, nobody in the Middle East has ever kept their word on a single agreement they have signed with Israel. No, the ink wasn't even dry yet, and they start attacking again. And I'll listen to you offline, sir.
All right, Bob. Thanks for the call.
You know, I mean, this just goes back to what I said earlier. I think there's tremendous blame on both sides all around. And, you know, the minute you point a finger at one particular incident, then the other side will point a finger at a preceding incident, and then the other side at an incident that preceded that one. And I just don't see this as useful if you're goal at this point is to try to reach a solution. You know, I mean, the fact is that the very presence of Israel has been problematic for the people in that region, the Palestinian people and the surrounding Arab and Islamic states ever since the birth of Israel in 1948. And so you've had a series of conflicts precipitated just by that very fact. And most of the region now, I think, has accommodated itself to the fact that Israel is there. It's not going away, and have, you know, sort of figured out a way to live with that. And what we're seeing now is, I think, kind of in many ways, sort of the last echoes, perhaps the last remnants of this conflict, which is boiled down in many respects to sort of, you know, the Palestinians and even really part of the Palestinians. You know, Hamas and Fatah, which is the other main party which controls the West Bank, are not on the same page. And one might even describe the Fatah government as closer to Israel than it is to Hamas. And so, you know, you just have this continual echoes of this problem that's arguably taken, you know, half a century to kind of settle into a solution. But I think that's been the arc of the story, that you've seen this, you know, original, one might describe it as this incursion into a Palestinian lands of a Jewish population that did not get received well. And then there's been a continuing series of skirmishes, which are kind of settling in now to a resolution. And I think probably my guess is, you know, couple decades from now, that this will probably be finally resolved.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Just in about 10 seconds, are you filled with hope this year, or are you worried about it?
Both. I think that, as I mentioned earlier, that there are huge crises on our plays. I mean, I think there's huge problems, and we've really actually dealt ourselves a great deal of those problems and a great deal of damage. At the same time, the new administration, I think, is an opportunity to really do things differently internationally and at home, and perhaps to solve many of these problems, and stylistically to change in dramatic ways. And so I have some hope and much consternation as well at the same time.
I'm with you. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, my pleasure, Kathleen. Thank you.
Professor David Michael Green, Associate Professor of Political Science at Hofstra University, our guest for All Things Political this January 5. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our new Milwaukee studios from the Royce Federal Plaza. And thank you for your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with our open line, so get your thoughts ready of what you'd like to have on the air. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.